Welcome to the Hypermotion Lab and our next series of talks. I'm sure most of you arrived probably just in the last hour or two since it's the first day. So also a warm welcome to the Hypermotion, the third one of its kind. And I quite like it. Much more to see, much more to try, bigger and nicer venue, lovelier stage here. It's great to see that this topic of micromobility, logistics, smart logistics, is getting more and more important. So our next talk, as you can hear, will be in English. If you want it in a translated version, das heißt, wenn Sie es gerne auf Deutsch hören möchten, dann können Sie sich dort hinten gerne Kopfhörer holen und die Simultanübersetzung genießen. So, our next topic is going to be very interesting. Anybody in here has ever been to Copenhagen? All of you, mostly. So I think the first time I was there was 5 years ago. And when I arrived, I was like, my God, this is such a beautiful city. So many people on the streets, such a life quality. Why did I not study here? I was very sad. And one of the reasons Copenhagen is such an attractive city and such a beautiful city started a lot of years ago. And actually, thanks to our next speaker, Professor Dr. Jan Gehl, he has a big, big part in Copenhagen becoming so beautiful. Because he back then was just a freshly graduating architect who was very interested in not doing what all the other colleagues were doing, building big, iconic buildings that leave a landmark, like the Opera in Sydney. But he was focused on creating atmospheres, cities that are worthwhile living in for the people who are living in the cities, and also people who are just on the sidewalk, not the ones in the 30th story up in the skyscraper. And pursuing that work, he has become one of the most renowned architects and city planners who help cities all around the world in making them more livable and creating more quality for the people inhabiting the buildings and the sidewalks and the whole city ecosystem. So by now he's consulting cities such as Shanghai, Manhattan, Moscow, and of course still Copenhagen. So one could say that he probably was one of the pioneers of consumer orientation, which now obviously has become one of the big, big terms for every company to center their product creation around, which, interestingly enough, we'll have another keynote just following. So it's a perfect combination. Being focused on life quality, he also brings a very interesting perspective to the Hypermotion today, because the Hypermotion obviously offers a lot of interesting gadgets. Electric gadgets to try out. We have the mobility parkour there. And it's easy to be enthusiastic about technology and to be enthusiastic about flying cabs, volocopters, or Lilium, about e-scooters. But it does not always mean it is the perfect solution for everybody or that it really solves the challenges we have in an urban environment. So today he wants to offer a third way out. Please welcome Jan Gehl.
Was that all? Thank you very much for inviting me, and let us get started. Yes, I can see here. I have this one. I'll start maybe with a reference to this exhibition. I'll start to talk a little bit about cities for the future and the great confusion about cities for the future which exists worldwide. Come on now. Here we are. Oh, yeah. I was in India for a conference, and there was this big poster for the conference, Future and the Past for India. And I went around with the poster and asked everybody, is this the future or is this the past? And they say, oh, that is the future. And I said, holy Moses, it looks like Atlanta in the 70s. But worse still, then I went to another conference about the new United Nations Urban Agenda and found exactly the Indian poster again with freeways, but now they have a bus lane and 2 hospitals and 6 windmills. Then I went to a conference in Stuttgart about the Altertum, And they showed this one, which was be the future city for dementia. And I said, oh, I hope I'll never get that disease and to live in that awful place. There is an interesting tendency when you talk about the future, you show something which is not really looking as if it was somewhere you like to live, really. But there are many other ideas, of course. Increasingly, we hear that when we have the automatic cars, all our problems we ever had will be solved. And they continue to say, you can just wait for that. Don't do anything, because when they come, they'll solve all our problems. And if they are not solved, all of them, the rest of them will be solved by drones and helicopters. And then, of course, whatever is left to be solved will be solved by smart city. And there are so many good ideas. There are so much technology, so many gimmicks around. This guy in the middle, he could not find the bike lane, but it's smart anyway. It gets smarter and smarter. And we see a fantastic hype about all these inventions. And I can understand it, because there are good money in these inventions. If you can have people to buy my gimmick, I'll be rich. So there's a lot of investments also here. They will not really enjoy these gimmicks in Bangladesh and in Indonesia and in Lagos in Africa. But here, if you have money, you can have an electric car and drive your kids to climate demonstration. That is smart. I will ask the question, are there anything we can do while we are waiting for the new technologies to solve all the problems we ever had? And my reflection will be, maybe we already have some ideas and some examples. Some could serve as models, and also models where we could start right away, or maybe even models where we don't have anything at all. We'll look at that. So I will talk about livable cities for the 21st century, and I will talk about the importance of putting people first in your planning, and think about the technology a little bit later. The background for all these problems, which I and many other people have worked with, has been the way we have learned to plan in the last 50 years. We've had two totally dominating planning paradigms. One was modernism, all this about Corbusier and the city is bad and what is good is freestanding buildings. Before we had modernism, all the cities were made of spaces, and all the building went out to the spaces. And if you think of an old city, it's just the spaces you can remember, and then the cathedral. All the rest are streets and squares. But with modernism, we started to have objects. The whole focus moved from spaces to objects, and was not built upon was leftover space. Here is the situation before. Everything in the old cities were geared to the spaces where people could use their city and meet and do all the things people have to do in the city. But now came, of course, all these objects. We had this focus on objects, and we had this new cast of architects, the bird sheet architects, who could go all over the world and deliver towers wherever there was a guy wanting a tower. Some people even think that if you make enough towers, you have a city, like in Dubai. But they don't have a city, they have a collection of towers. Modernism, in my point of view, was very technocratic and didn't know much about people. And all the spaces which were left over from the modernism, or the thinking of the modernist, were really lousy places for people. They were not inviting at all. These guys knew nothing about what was inviting for people. Also, what happened with the modernism was that the scale of cities and Siedlungen and places to live was completely blown. We could build so large and we could build so high, and we completely forgot what human scale was, and we got utterly confused about scale. And still today, there are hardly any architects who can build nice human scale spaces for people in cities. The other big big paradigm, and I say that these paradigms really started to be influencing in 1960, because that was when we really started the rebuilding after the war, and that was when the cars really started to stream into our societies. And then we had the car invasion. It was a very old invention, the car. It was made in the Wild West Hunter 20 years ago, where Henry Ford got the idea. It was first in Mannheim, I know. But Henry Ford said, if everybody get a ton of steel and four rubber wheels, he will be mobile. And that idea we have worked on ever since. We have not come up with any new ideas, really. But it's just got worse and worse and worse. So this is, of course, a pedestrian crossing in Moscow, which serves also as a parking space and as a training space for the Olympic Winter Olympics in slalom. Also with the cars, there was a further confusion about scale, because now we made everything in 60 kilometer an hour scale, big spaces, big signs, no details, you can't see them anyway. And there's a fantastic difference between 5 kilometer an hour scale for people and 60 kilometer an hour scale, which makes the car happy. The cars have, of course, in the years, they become more and more dominant. And we have worked with one city after the other, everything we can to make the cars happy. And we've come really a long way. What is characteristic that all cities I know of, they have a department for transport and traffic, and all these cities, they count all the cars every year, and they have prognosis and policies and programming about the traffic. They know everything about traffic. When it comes to people and public life, they typically never have a department for that. And typically, they never have any information or documentation about what people use the city and how it is used. That has been for a long while the situation, not anymore though. I said 1960, it really started to go fast with these two movements. What did we know about how the built environment influenced people's quality of life? In 60, we knew next to nothing. Just at that time, in 1961, the first voice saying was Jane Jacobs in New York. She was living in Greenwich Village. There was this fantastic plan to save New York by taking New York away and making a number of freeways across Manhattan and put high-rise along the freeways, because that will be a good city based on modernistic ideas. Unfortunately, Jane Jacobs lived in Greenwich Village and she raised a fantastic popular movement. They prevented the freeways from being built, and she wrote about her viewpoints in the book The Death and Life of Great American Cities. She said, if we let the modernists and the motorists build our cities, they will be dead cities and forget about the great cities. She has become now the godmother of humanistic city planning. And I saw this poster in Toronto. You can see Jesus is looking after the end of days, and Jane Jacobs is looking after the future. She's really very famous by now. I shall tell you about my own life story in a very, very short version. I was trained as an architect in the 50s, and what did we do in the 50s on School of Architecture? We were standing over models all the time, being good, trained to be good modernists. We moved the objects around. Be bingo, this is a good city. And this guy was famous for saying that a good housing area is something which looks good from the Autobahn. And here is a Swedish project he has made which is really good from the Autobahn. I think it was the worst period of city planning ever. That was the 60s and the 50s. I went out of School of Architecture to do all these wonderful things for mankind. And then I married a psychologist, and then suddenly the climate in the house changed, because all these young architects and psychologists, they met, and all the time the psychologists were saying, why are you not interested in people? We were very offended by, of course we are interested in people, huh? Why don't you teach you anything about people in schools of architecture? Why do your professors go out 4 o'clock in the morning to take photos of monuments to be sure there are no disturbing people in the foreground? Whatever you do, you manipulate with the quality of life for people, but you don't know a thing about it. That was not so easy for a young architect. So I had to go back to School of Architecture for 40 more years to ask them what they did not tell me in the first 5 years, just to find out that nobody knew anything. Actually, what was believed was that it didn't matter how things looked and were organized, because Homo sapiens would adapt to anything, and as long as there were hot water in the tap, he would be happy. What I worked on was to make the people who use our buildings and our cities visible. And what method I used was to sit on my behind for 40 years and watch how people use cities and architecture and buildings, whatever. And based on that, we started to produce books. And to my great surprise, they started to be distributed all over the world, because they had no knowledge nowhere. And there was a strong irritation and a strong urge to know more about people in cities and people in architecture, because many things were not functioning very well. So my little books were pushed all over the place, and then came a bigger book, the State of Your Mention, which is common in all the major languages like Myanmar and Arabic, and yeah, even in French. That took 40 years, and it was not published in France, not in Paris, no, in Montreal. Then they exported it to Paris, but that's another story. But now these books have spread very quickly, because I realize it's not because they are very good books, because there's not much else about people in cities. But summing up about this research, now after 50 years, we know how we can make fantastic new towns, how we can make fantastic new housing development, Siedlung, how we can clean up after the automobiles in existing cities. We know a lot now about people and architecture and city planning. It's not being used so much yet, but it's being used more and more. I'll tell you about that after 50 years, around year 2000, we could see a change of direction of wind. Then people became more and more interested in that we shall have livable cities, we shall have sustainable cities, we shall have healthy cities. And if you ask any mayor in the world, he will say, oh, that is my program. All this about lively and livable, that is the very, very old thing about the public space. And it's about that the major thing, the major interest of human beings are other human beings. And we always were able to meet the other people in the public spaces face to face. And some people will say that now we can use this one and we don't need to meet nobody. But think about being sent out in Sahara with this one for 2 months, and then think about what state your mind will be in. We need stimulation every 4 seconds in our life, and other people have throughout been our main interest. So public space and even little meetings of people, that this is very popular. You can see that every time an architect delivers a project, it is full of happy people doing things they would never think of doing normally. But that shows the client that it is a great project. If it wasn't great, they will go home right away and there will be nobody. And if there are nobody, it will also be a signal it must be a lousy project and he will start to be worried. So you have to people wash all your drawings because people like people. Also, increasingly, we are, and I will not come into that very much because so much is written and talked about this, but we have to do much, much more about making sustainable cities. The cities are the main source of most of the CO2 and many other problems. And of course, if we walk and bike more, that's good. But if we are to find alternatives to the automobile also, to have shared transportation, it could be a matter of shared transportation and walking and biking, which could be a very good system. Also now we have a new challenge, that is the sitting syndrome. My daughter is a doctor and she tells me all the time that we shall make cities where you invite people to walk and to bike as much as possible, because then we can live 7 years longer and have a much better life and be much cheaper for the health system in our societies. So we have to move rather much every day, and some of these instruments here is not really inviting people to move. So when you're finished with these various gimmicks, you have to move anyway 1 hour every day. Think of that. World Health Organization say make cities for walking and bicycling. Also, we have now increasing number of elderly people. And my take here is that looking carefully after people in city planning will address all these things in one movement. But then we can ask the question, are there cities who really have as a policy to invite people to walk and bicycle as much as possible? Yes, there are more and more cities all over the world who does this. And because of this guy who tells me I have 5 minutes left, I will of course jump over this almost. No. Melbourne, I could tell about Melbourne for hours. We worked with Melbourne since 85. It was an awful city. Now it's one of the best cities. It's the best city in the world. It's the best city in the Southern Hemisphere. They have done so much for Melbourne. They say in Melbourne we walk, and they made all the sidewalks wider and put a lot of trees, and they did a lot of other things. And Melbourne now is so nice that it's almost as nice as Paris, but the weather is much better. And if you don't know what to do, move to Melbourne right away. Sydney is famous for its waterfront. But if you look at the city center in Sydney some years ago, it was absolutely awful. We worked hard with Sydney to get the cars and the buses and the noise and the fumes out of city center. And lo and behold, in 2 weeks' time from now, they will introduce their new light rail up down the main street where you had all the buses and the cars. It's pedestrian and light rail. And it looked like this, and in 2 weeks' time, it will look like that. It already looks like that. So they are still transforming cities. In New York, I'll not talk about, but there has been a major change in New York. Times Square is one of the things we know about. They were able to take Times Square away from the cars and give it to the people. And it didn't matter a thing because they didn't need Broadway for traffic. They thought so. Vilnius is up to a good start. And in Bucharest, they have a little problem, but now they have my books in Romanian, and they will sort the problem very, very shortly. I talked about these cities in a conference in Montreal, and this guy came running up to me and said, I'm from Moscow, I'm the deputy mayor of Moscow. We would like to humanize Moscow. We will have, do it fast, 12 months, humanize Moscow. When can you come? I said, we come on Monday. So we went there on Monday, and we were completely shocked because at that time, 2011, 2012, Moscow was completely inundated, completely swarmed with motor cars. They had no rules for parking, and they parked everywhere. Freedom from communism is the right to park everywhere. And here they are parking, they have freedom here. This is Main Street Moscow, full of parked cars, absolutely gray, and the air is full of advertisements. They published all my books in 3 months, and then they hired us to tell them what to do. And then they started the most fantastic process of cleaning up Moscow and making Moscow much more people-friendly. This is Main Street, 211. This is just a year and a half later. It's now the gray street has become green. The cars have disappeared. There are benches now, and the advertisement has disappeared. You can see Kremlin. This is a little street next to the Main Street. And just a few years later, it looked like this. This is a little corner near Pushkin Monument. It was a little bit, a few things have moved in there, but now, bong, they have just changed it. All the canals and rivers were lined with cars and parked cars, and they are full speed now winning back the waterfront for the people of Moscow. This is a place where a very important metro station has its outlet, and people step right out into the five-lane street. Now they step out into a pedestrian square. And what is this? This is the Moscow swings. They put them up on the squares, and the Moscovites, they're very, very happy about swinging. They swing from early morning to late night. Last time I was in Moscow, they say, Jan, we have a new problem now, the Moscow baby boom. All these benches you put up, all these cars you've taken out of the parks, you make room on the sidewalks. We have baby boom. It's a problem. It's a blame of the humanistic city planning. I'm very proud of having a baby boom allocated to city planning. Now we could, and I have no time. I know we have no time. So the story about Copenhagen, you will have a very short version. But Copenhagen was the first of all the cities to start. They were the first, almost the first, to take the traffic out of Main Street. And it was said it can never work in Europe. It's too cold and we are not Italians. The moment we had the space, we were Italians. We become more and more Italians. This was Copenhagen in 62. For 57 years, they worked on improving the conditions for pedestrians. And we found what you count, you care for. As long as they counted all the cars, they cared only for the cars. Now we only also started in Copenhagen to count all the people and to document how the city was used. And that was started in the 60s, and we've done it in university ever after. City has done it. So we know a lot about the life in the city, what works, what does not work, where can we do more. What you count, you care for. Count, make documentation. The university and city work closely together. It had a fantastic influence on the city, and when the city now is among the most livable in the world, they say it's because we had the university to do the research or start it. Copenhagen looked like all the other ones, and they have changed all these sceneries. And Copenhagen today, they've done so much, and also Copenhagen, first city in the world to have an official plan. We will be the best city for people in the world, and that should be because we want livability, sustainability, better health, social inclusion, democracy, make good places for people. And then I could continue here with or not. We also did a lot for bicycles from very early on, and there's a complete system of very good bicycle lanes, and there's an efficient transportation system, and it's integrated with the public transportation. It's very, very popular to take your bike in the train. It become a culture. Everybody is bicycling, businessmen and pregnant mothers. Even this immigrant from Australia has started to bicycle. And old people are being bicycled, and they are very happy about it. And then, of course, we have gradually got more and more bicycle. Then we have a very serious problem, congestion on the bicycle lanes. What do you do there? You just double the bicycle lanes and take more asphalt from the cars and give it to the bicycles. There can be five times more bicycles on a bike lane than there can be people on a car lane. And what has happened in Copenhagen is that the latest count was that 49% of all people going to work and studies in Copenhagen arrived on bicycles. Just 10 years ago, it was 38%. So there's been an enormous increase for 20, 30 years in when they did better infrastructure, people are invited, and now it's faster to go by bicycle than any other means. So what did we learn from Copenhagen and from the other cities? We have learned for years and years, if you make more roads, you get more traffic. But what happens if you get better conditions for public life, pedestrians and bicycles? You get more walking, more public life, and much more bicycling. Actually, walking and public life is up by 20% also in the last 10 years. So there's a model here for the 21st century. And that is a model of putting people first in city planning. It's the simplest and the cheapest you can do in a city. It creates a better city for everyone. It can be used also in Bangladesh and in Lagos and all over the world, because there are homo sapiens everywhere. And you can start tomorrow, and you don't have to wait for all these gimmicks to be developed. And you have to do it anyway. And if you want to know how to do it, there are a few books now in German. Go ahead, good luck, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Jan Gehl. So, thanks a lot for these insights. We still will take maybe 2 or 3 minutes for questions. There were 2 questions that you can say using the app. Either go into the Hypermotion app and click on Slido, or go directly with the mobile browser to slido.com and you can type away your questions. So the first question is, how can you transform like the suburban one family per home areas, because there's still 2/3 of the society who live more in these areas.
And all the single family house areas are built on 2 good ideas. One is a well-functioning nuclear family, father, mother, 3 kids, and good income, and preferably one person to go home and look after everything. And the other idea is cheap petroleum. Both these things are changed now. The nuclear family, the well-functioning nuclear family, are not so common. I think there are 32 family types now. And the other thing is the cheap and endless petroleum is not there anymore. We have a problem, Houston. The only place where I have seen that they have a very interesting plan, that's in Melbourne. In Melbourne, they have a plan to save all the suburbs. It's called Linear Barcelona, and you can look it up on the internet. It's the city architect who has done wonders in Melbourne, who has also went on to say, what can we do with the suburbs? And basically, it's about building along the transport corridors and take down some of the buildings so that all the rest will have much more service and can walk and bicycle to the service and are not depending on the car no more.
Do you think that's something where the government should actively put up regulations to guide people also to stay in the suburban areas and to counter urbanization?
We have enormous investments in the suburbs, so we'll have to come up with ideas. So it's not an option to take them down. They have started in some American cities to take certain suburbs down. I certainly think that we will have to use that investment and make sure that it can work also for a population of elderly people.
You just said your book is out in German for the first time. Is that the reason that you haven't worked with any German city so far, because they didn't want to read your book in English or Danish?
It took 40 years for my first book was out until the first book came out in Germany. But now in 6 years, 7 years, there are 3 books out.
What do you think could Frankfurt do? What would you suggest? Like maybe the first thing to change in
Frankfurt?
I
don't believe in having opinions seen from a taxi window between the airport and the Messehalle. I haven't studied Frankfurt very much. I know something about other German cities, but not about Frankfurt. But it's basically the same cure everywhere, like in Moscow, like in Sydney. That is that we start by finding out how are people using this city. And then we can make a map of how cities used. And we have these recordings from all cities and say, there should be, like in Moscow, we could see that there were very few people on the main street because there were no room. And we said that a city like this, based on other examples, there should be this many thousands a day on the sidewalks here, and you only have 4,000 or something. That's because you don't allow people to use your main street. So if you want more business, you make room. Oh! So at once they had. Also, when we changed Times Square, there were careful documentation that 11% of all the people in Times Square were in cars, but the cars had 91% of the space. And 89% of the people were on the sidewalks on 10% of the space. And then...
So you have to change
then
that
number. Then we could change
around.
It. There were good arguments.
I think what you just mentioned, not having an opinion, but actually having a look, talking to people, observing them, that's a perfect transition to our next topic, something our next speaker, Wolfgang Henseler, will talk about. So thanks for the transition, and thanks for joining us today, Dr. Jan Gehl.